It is Monday, December the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the plight of civilians caught in the fighting in the Syrian city of Aleppo.
People of Aleppo and surrounding areas have been caught between two extremes, Salafist extremists and the Syrian government and their Russian and Iranian and other allies.
Also ahead, the people who choose U.S. presidents will meet later today. We'll have a sweet story out of Kampala, Uganda, plus the top country music albums of 2016. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The UN humanitarian advisor for Syria, Jan Egelin, lashed out Sunday at al-Qaeda-aligned rebel fighters for upending a fragile evacuation deal for civilians in the city of Aleppo, labeling jihadists as reckless. Egelin warned that burning earlier in the day of two buses that were meant to evacuate Shiites from two small towns of neighboring Aleppo risk imperiling all relief efforts. Evacuations were suspended from eastern Aleppo on Friday by the government in Damascus as rebel groups, international organizations, and the Syrian government traded accusations about who was to blame. Russia said the operation to evacuate civilians and insurgents from eastern Aleppo was complete, but there is a lot more to the story as we hear from Egelin.
The Russian Federation announced that there are four humanitarian corridors that they want to sit down now in Aleppo with our people there to discuss how we can use the four corridors to evacuate people out, especially we have at least 400 wounded that need immediate medical evacuation, but also to use these corridors to get medical supplies and food in.
UN Security Council has been expected to vote on Sunday on whether to send observers to Aleppo to oversee the evacuations and help provide protection for the civilians who remain, but that vote was postponed until later today. Well, for some perspective on what's happening in Aleppo that has left civilians to endure all kinds of atrocities, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with University of San Francisco regional scholar Stephen Zunis.
There have been atrocities and threats of atrocities on both sides. And, of course, it is the innocent civilians who are caught in the middle of this. The situation remains unclear, and it's really imperative that some kind of international observers are able to get there and to sort things out or at least be witnesses so that it might deter future atrocities and facilitate the evacuation of civilians.
Apparently, France and Russia have struck some sort of compromise Sunday for a UN Security Council resolution to move forward that would prevent so-called mass atrocities in areas like eastern Aleppo and in Idlib province.
That's a very good development. Indeed, they can come through with some kind of compromise. There have been a lot of rumors, charges on both sides. Even though Aleppo was the home of some of the leading moderate oppositionists back in the early days of the uprising when it was largely nonviolent and pro-democracy, the struggle since then has been largely led by hardcore Islamists who are not appreciated much by the population either. So the people of Aleppo and surrounding areas have been caught between two extremes, Salafist extremists who have tried to impose their hardline version of Islam and have shelled civilian areas and government-held territories and in many ways kept people as hostages. And the Syrian government and their Russian and Iranian and other allies that have facilitated bombing and shelling, which have taken even more civilian lives. So it's been a tragedy all around. And while the cessation of the fighting has led to hope that the carnage, at least in this part of Syria, may be over, things are still tense enough that the risk of more bloodletting is still very possible.
Are these evacuations a sign of victory for the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and Russia?
Well, certainly this can be seen as a victory for the Syrian regime, Aleppo being the country's largest city, and then until a few years ago, the commercial center of the country. is now almost completely in government hands. But the destruction has just been incredible. I've been to Aleppo myself, and I don't recognize it looking at the pictures. I mean, it is like the scenes one could see in the Central and Eastern Europe at the end of World War II. You know, shells of these buildings, apartment blocks, and others. It has been a humanitarian disaster all around.
So this arrangement of the evacuations has been worked out in part by Russia and Turkey. What is Turkey's stake in all this?
Well, Turkey has actually been a major player. They have been one of the major arms suppliers and supporters of a number of the opposition militia in this part of Syria, including Aleppo. They have served as a conduit for supplies and as well as for foreign fighters who have been part of the armed groups that have been fighting the government. Given the patchwork of control by various militia, Turkey is also a logical route through which humanitarian supplies and other kinds of relief can come through. So Turkey's cooperation is important in this, but it is primarily the Syrian government. It's the Syrian government that controls most of the area. It's the Syrian government that is responsible for the majority of the atrocities and the manifold violations of international humanitarian law. And it would be a very positive development if the Russians, which have blocked effective United Nations action up until this time, would finally be willing to allow at least some UN presence in the city to come in at least as observers and hopefully be able to play a constructive role in ending the city's agony.
University of San Francisco's Stephen Zunis, an American international relations scholar specializing in Middle Eastern politics. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among other stories we're following here on VOA, Lebanon's new prime minister vowing to shield the country from the war in Syria, Washington lacking some consensus on the Russian hacking, plus a computer programmers while they're taking aim at high cost of medicine in Nigeria. Expanded coverage of those stories, a lot more at voanews.com and always on the VOA mobile app. The next chapter in what is sometimes described as the tumultuous U.S. presidential election plays out today, with voting and the Electoral College expected to officially confirm that billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump will become the country's next president. Americans have known since early November that Trump would take over the White House when he is inaugurated January the 20th. U.S. presidential elections, however, are not determined by the national popular vote, but rather by the individual outcomes in presidential balloting in all 50 states and here in Washington, D.C. Politico Politics reporter Kyle Cheney explains this confusing electoral system to International Edition's Lori London.
And I'm not surprised that most people don't get this process because it's usually such a in the background part of what the way elections work here. What happens is, and this has been true in every presidential election in the country's history, when people vote, they're not actually choosing a candidate. They're choosing a set of electors from their state, from their party, really. So the winning party of that state, that's the set of electors that gathers several weeks after Election Day and formally picks the president. So normally, they just go ahead and choose the same candidate of the party that the people have picked. However, this election has been unlike any other. And it's kind of fitting that this part of the process is getting thrust to the forefront as people try to overturn the results on Election Day and pick someone who isn't Trump.
We've been hearing a lot of things about unbelievable pressure being put on these people like we've never seen before as well. People getting hate mail, people getting threats, hundreds of thousands of letters in the mail and emails. What do we know about this?
Well, people are awakening. In a way, it's a sign of how engaged people are. You know, this process has gone on every time, and the electors, nobody ever knows who they are. Nobody realizes they even exist. This time, people have realized there's this whole group of people that could change the outcome of this election if they were to switch their votes away from Donald Trump. and it's thrust them into the spotlight like never before. So there are groups out there that are sending mail, emails by the thousands every day to Republican electors trying to get them to ditch Donald Trump. It's escalated in some cases. Some electors reported getting threats, feeling unsafe. There's advertisements out there. Celebrities put a YouTube video together that's also, I think, part in a paid ad as well, targeting electors. And so it's really just a sign of how much people are focusing on this as the last chance, especially on the left, to stop Donald Trump.
Right. I know we've seen some celebrities putting out ads and all kinds of organizations. I don't think there's ever been this much dissent. And of course, we know Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. So I'm sure that has something to do with it. This was an unusual campaign, to say the least. It's an unusual couple of candidates. What happens next?
Well, so the electors will gather in their state capitals all day Monday and cast the official vote for president. The anti-Trump folks, they're not viewed as very likely to succeed in what they're doing. It's an extremely uphill battle for them to convince 37 minimum Republicans to abandon Donald Trump. That's a huge number. No, it's never come close to that in this country's history. And, however, if they were to do that, it would actually send the election to the House of Representatives, which would vote in January to resolve the contest.
You don't think it's very likely that there will be 37 GOP electors that will vote against Donald Trump?
It's hard to imagine. There's only one who's spoken out publicly saying he will definitely be voting against Trump. There's really got to be 36 more. And we've seen no evidence that these people are emerging. The groups trying to make it happen claim that they're making inroads and making progress. But again, without hard evidence or anyone speaking out publicly, it's hard to fathom them really getting to that 37 number.
What happens after the vote? Do we know right away, or do we have to wait for that, too?
This process has been so neglected over the years. I don't really know the answer to that. A lot of these states have public ceremonies, and so there'll be people there observing and seeing, what the electors do. But it's not clear if they say out loud, I'm voting for this person, and they write something down differently on their paper ballot, which is the only official ballot. We won't know that. If it's not even close and Donald Trump is just easily whisked right in, it'll be pretty clear. But if there's some dissent out there, there may be some questions about how things are cast and what legal challenges and things like that. So it could be a little messy.
That's Kyle Cheney, that is. He's a politics reporter for Politico. He was speaking with my colleague Lori London. Later in the program, Michael Lippin will be along with what's trending on social media, and the Electoral College is one of those big stories. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. An unlikely chess club in the slums of Kampala became a global powerhouse, and that particular story, an inspiring story, the club's founder and members became not only a book, but also a movie. VOA's Faith Lapidus has more on how Queen of Katwe, the movie, is helping the kids of Katwe, the slum.
Robert Katende started this chess program 14 years ago for children with disabilities in Kampala. Now it attracts hundreds of kids in 300 locations across Uganda.
I never imagined what it has turned out to be, for sure, because all what I was looking at was to see how best I would be able to empower these kids, to help them realize their full potential.
Queen of Katwe, the new movie from Disney, tells the story of Katende's chess clubs and Fiona Mutesi, the young girl who became a world chess champion despite her modest background. The film is set in the overcrowded slum of Katwe in the Ugandan capital, where Katende wanted to be a football coach for disadvantaged kids. But he noticed they weren't that interested in playing sports, so he decided to teach them chess instead. He started out with a team of 5 boys, whom he called the Pioneers. Fiona Mutesi joined later, and in a few years, the team was traveling around the world to represent Uganda in international competitions. Richard Tugume is one of the original pioneers.
The film, I think it's actually transforming a lot of lives of the people in Katwe, because personally, I believe now that it doesn't matter wherever you come from, because people here come from slums, but whoever will watch that movie will be able to know that there is life outside Katwe.
During the movie premiere in Kampala, the local actors shared the limelight with stars like British-Nigerian actor David Oyelowo, who plays Katende.
It was invaluable shooting in Katwe because it's such a specific place. And that's what I love about the film. What I loved about the script is its specificity. It wasn't just a general African country. This wasn't just a general depiction of a girl's life.
The experience of living in poverty is familiar to many of the film's Ugandan actors. Medina Nalwanga, who plays Fiona, used to sell corn as a child. Martin Kabanza, who plays her brother Brian, was also a child street vendor.
I used to walk around on the streets with shoes, selling them with my father, which I think it's somehow related to what I was doing in the movie. So I was like doing my real story.
And the movie, for the most part, sticks to that real amazing story of believing in yourself. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
It is time now to check out what's trending on social media. International Edition's Michael Lippin here with the latest. Hey, Michael, I understand one of the big stories getting social media reaction is the death of a U.S. medical celebrity.
Hi, Steve. We're talking about Dr. Henry Heimlich, who pioneered an anti-choking technique in the 1970s that has helped to save many lives here in the U.S. and around the world ever since. It's a technique known as the Heimlich Maneuver. Heimlich lived a very long life, dying on Saturday at the age of 96 at a hospital in the Midwestern city of Cincinnati, Ohio.
So, Michael, how's the social media world reacting?
Well, Heimlich is one of the top trending topics on Facebook today, and the New York Times Facebook post of his obituary has been drawing lots of comments. What's interesting about these comments is that they aren't just people paying tribute. They're actually Facebook users giving testimonials about when they used the Heimlich maneuver themselves. Here's one from Lisa Noto Adelson. I did the maneuver on my daughter when she was 3 and choking on a piece of fruit. So glad I knew what to do. I will never forget that day. Rest in peace, Henry Heimlich.
You know, I understand another popular topic out there is the blend of pop culture and the U.S. election. Now, what can you tell us about all of that?
Right, Steve. The U.S. election isn't over yet, believe it or not. That's because the last step in the process of confirming the president-elect is having the members of the U.S. Electoral College cast their votes based on who won the popular votes in each of the U.S. states last month. Now, as we've been reporting, the final step is scheduled for Monday here in the U.S., and traditionally, the Republican and Democratic members of the Electoral College vote exactly according to who won each state. If all those electors follow that tradition, a majority will pick Donald Trump because he did beat Hillary Clinton in the race for a majority of the Electoral College votes up for grabs. But this wasn't a traditional election, as many people know, and many Democrats and liberal Americans have been trying to persuade some of the Republican electors to not pick Trump. Now for the pop culture. Saturday Night Live, a popular satirical TV show here in the U.S., had some fun last night with that persuasion campaign and became a top trend on Facebook. SNL performer Kate McKinnon reprised her role as Hillary Clinton, and this time she was knocking on the front door of a supposed Republican elector and pleading with her to not vote for Trump. But instead of speaking, the Hillary caricature silently uses a series of cue cards, just like the famous movie scene from that hit romantic comedy Love Actually, which I confess I haven't watched yet. But the SNL skit is just hilarious, and you've got to go online to see what's written on those cue cards, as well as the expressions on Kate McKinnon's face as she makes her pleas. Steve?
You're absolutely right, Michael. It was a funny skit. Many thanks. International Edition's Michael Lippin. By the way, you can follow Michael on Twitter at @Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by Finnish researchers and published in the journal Age and Aging suggests taking frequent sauna baths can reduce the risk of dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease. Scientists from the University of Eastern Finland followed 2,000 middle-aged men for 20 years as part of its ongoing Kuopio ischemic heart disease risk factor study. They found that participants who took sauna baths between 4 to 7 times per week were 66% less likely of being diagnosed with dementia than those doing so once a week. An earlier report from the continuing study indicated that frequent sauna bathing also considerably decreases the risk of sudden cardiac death and other such cardiac events, as well as overall mortality. According to the paper's authors, the association between sauna bathing and the risk of dementia had not been studied until now. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And this is VOA's International Edition. The Billboard year-end charts are out, and Nikki Strong of VOA 1, The Hits, joins International Edition Sarah Williams to tell us about some of the top country albums of 2016.
Nikki, how are these charts compiled?
Well, for the top country albums chart, basically it's via Nielsen, which uses a sales tracking system.
Well, there are lists of the most critically acclaimed albums, and then there's Billboard's list based on sales. Have you found a major difference in these two?
Yeah, well, many albums loved by critics and fans, some that were even nominated and won awards, didn't make it to the top 25 on Billboard. Case in point, Aubrey Sellers' New City Blues, Brandi Clark, Big Day in a Small Town, Brothers Osborne, Porn Shop, Miranda Lambert, Weight of These Wings, Marco Price, Midwest Farmer's Daughter, Loretta Lynn. Full circle.
Yeah, they sound like a lot of them are women.
Yeah, a lot of them are women. I think critics and people are loving what a lot of these women artists do. It's just they're not getting the sales and marketing push that moves units.
Were there surprises in the Billboard top five?
Yes, yes. Okay, so the top five consist of Sam Hunt's Montevallo, who was the number one album of 2015, by the way. He's number five this year. I think that's great. Number four is Carrie Underwood, Storyteller. Number three is Blake Shelton, If I'm Honest. And number two was the big surprise. Number two is Joey and Rory. Now, they're an incredibly courageous couple. They were fighting cancer. And they openly blogged their journey, and it riveted many of us in country music and beyond. It was a journey of faith, and they were totally transparent. And this year, we lost Joey Feek. But in the process, they actually recorded one final album together, and this is the album. It's called Hymns, and it really is a tribute to their faith. And the album didn't receive much airplay at all, but their story and music obviously moved tons of people, so many of us, that it translated to their ranking of number two.
Who was at the top of the list?
Ah, Chris Stapleton, Traveler. I call him country music's bearded Viking. He provided another kind of hope, hope that traditional country music could be just as successful and commercially viable as contemporary country, and that artists who do it can experience both commercial success and critical acclaim.
You can hear Nikki Strong count down the top 20 country albums of 2016, according to Billboard, this week on VOA 1's Country Hits. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and Twitter at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Clearly the story of my life. Don't know where I've been. Don't know where I'm going. Huh? Everyone in the control room looking the same way. We're here anyway. It's always good to have Nikki Strong on. Isn't she great? She's wonderful. Anyway, moving along. Sad news now. Hungarian-born actress and raconteur Zsa Zsa Gabor, known a lot more for her marriages, a bunch of them, talk show appearances than the film she was in, died on Sunday after suffering a heart attack. She was believed to be 99 years old, but there is no exact determination of exactly how old she was. Gabor was a show business personality during my era, very well known, whose critics say famous for just being famous instead of a signature film or television role. Appearing on the Phil Donahue show back in 1991, Gabor said she wasn't as mean and bad as some had described her.
To make these things clear, I love my animals. I have 16 horses, which take all my money because they eat, and they have shoes. And then I have... They have to get more expensive than my shoes. They are Tennessee Walkers, but not on the high show, on the Fletcher. And then I have 8 dogs, and I have a wonderful daughter. And I tell you one thing, I never got alimony or a child support from my husband, only because I didn't want it to, because nobody's going to buy me.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. It's very important to keep the best shoes on your horses, let me tell you. Zsa Zsa Gabor came to the United States with her equally well-known sisters Eva and Magna. That was in the late 1930s and soon began a career in Hollywood. Some of her more memorable film roles included appearances in the film Moulin Rouge, A Touch of Evil, and Lily. She also was in Batman. She played a villain, but Gabor made most of her fame playing this amiable socialite adored diamonds, furs, and remained lovable even while flaunting her wealth. She was in the TV series Green Acres. That was back in the 1960s. Her trademark was to call everyone she met darling, she said. She admitted she did that because she just couldn't remember everyone's names. Got the problem, too. Thanks for tuning into The Voice America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Throughout this holiday season, the United States government is profiling the cases of prisoners unjustly held around the world and the families they leave behind. The campaign is sponsored by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and is known as #FreeToBeHome Political Prisoner Campaign. The stories of these individuals highlight the broader struggle faced by so many families of political prisoners who have to commemorate countless family occasions with loved ones behind bars. One such individual is Ukrainian film director Oleg Sentsov, who was arrested in Crimea in 2014, shortly after Russia's occupation of the peninsula, in retaliation for his vocal opposition to the occupation. In 2015, a Russian court convicted him and a fellow activist, Alexander Kolchenko, of plotting terrorist attacks in Crimea in a trial that Amnesty International described as redolent of Stalinist-era show trials. Heather McGill, a researcher at Amnesty International, went on to say, "This trial was fatally flawed and credible allegations of torture and other ill treatment have been ignored by the court." Sentsov was given a 20-year sentence and is incarcerated in a penal colony in the Siberian region of Yakutia, about 3,500 miles from Ukraine's capital, Kiev. He has not seen his two young children or wife since. His co-defendant, Kolchenko, received a 10-year sentence. At least 10 Ukrainians are serving long jail sentences in Russia following dubious trials. Others are in captivity in separatist-run eastern Ukraine or in occupied Crimea. In a letter from Sentsov, smuggled out of prison in September, he wrote, "There are many of us held in Russia, and even more in Donbass. Some have been freed, others hope and wait." Sentsov was detained for exercising his universal rights. He represents thousands of other prisoners unjustly detained around the world. The United States, said Ambassador Power, calls on all governments, including Russia, to release their political prisoners. Political prisoners should be free to believe. They should be free to be loved. They should be free to be home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.